40 minutes or so of the afternoon, we'll be hearing from Joseph Kapil and Ajahn Pasno. Joseph was Ajahn Chah's chief nurse and set up the nursing care for him for the first 3 years after his the failing of his health. And then Ajahn Pasno was very deeply involved in the later care for him, the latter part of those 10 years, and also was one of the main organizers for the royal funeral. So the two of them will share their memories and reflections on that fading of Ajahn Chah's years. And then we'll be also be aiming to finish promptly at 5. So please don't be scared that we're going to carry on, keep you here all night. Even though that, of course, will be a teaching. But we don't intend to do that.
After the trip in 1979 to the UK, here to the States, back to the UK and back to Thailand, I remember on the plane traveling back with Lung Pa, I'd mentioned to him it might be nice to go off and spend some time alone. And I had never really had that opportunity outside of his monasteries, because as I mentioned earlier, Ajahn Sumedho left, and I'd been about 5 or 6 years, and then I took over as the senior monk. So one day we were over after we were back from the trip, and it was Ajahn Jokro and myself, who unfortunately couldn't be here today. And he kind of turned and said to me, well, since Jokro's here, he could look after the monastery, and you can go off to that cave or wherever it is you wanted to go. So it was his way of it's not like what you should do, but I'd kind of set it up, and it was like his way of giving his blessing, his permission to do something that I had really had a desire to do. So I went off and spent about 2 years, of which the tail end was about 4 months alone in a cave down in the southern province of Thailand. And I returned when it was Ajahn Sumedho's first visit back to Thailand, and I had made a vow not to leave the cave until something of great importance other than my own wanting to leave solitude would take me out. And so I figured Ajahn Sumedho was coming to town, that was important enough. Of course he would want to see me and be around to help him and share all those nice sweets that he would be getting in Bangkok and whatever. I ended up staying back at Wat Pa Pong and being around Ajahn Chah. And I want to try to keep the details kind of sparse. There's so much I could say about this period, but his health had been failing for some time, and he'd been diagnosed initially with diabetes, and was doctors were attempting, let's say, to keep him on some kind of regime, watch his sweets intake, and I believe was taking medicine at one point to help with that. And as the rains retreat approached, and this would have been the rains retreat, I believe, of 1981, this well-known monastery, Wat Thum Seng Phet, where I first met Ajahn Sumedho, where I spent my first rains retreat, very beautiful place. Kun Ying Tun, a very wealthy supporter of his, who had built this huge meditation hall, one of the biggest you would ever see, and a huge Buddha image and a reclining Buddha. And Thum Seng Phet, it's translated as the Cave of the Diamond Light, and it had caves and just a beautiful kind of setting for a monastery. And also on top, right almost next door to this big meeting hall, assembly hall, she built him a lovely hut, or not even a hut, it was a cottage. I guess that would be accurate, a cottage, yeah. It was not like, in all sense, it had a water tank underneath to collect rainwater, and was done in all this beautiful stone and mosquito screening on the inside, and nice toilet shower and everything. It was very, very well done. So his intention was to go there for that rains retreat with his failing health and just kind of chill, really to have some downtime, because here's a man you've seen from the films, all that we're talking. This man is basically giving 24 hours a day, other than he's asleep or he's in the privacy of taking care of the calls of nature, people are with him, they're around him. And we can only imagine the drain that must be. So here's this great master really starting to feel his limitations and his health failing. And so we went up there for him to rest, and I had the kind of rather unpleasant and arduous task of trying to control in some way access to him. So you can imagine everybody was used to hundreds, thousands of people when they arrived that he was there, he was available. And all of a sudden, old Pabakro here had to be the one to kind of stand in the way and be the one to kind of regulate the time and the access and when, with his permission. This is what he wanted. And, of course, nobody could understand that time is kind of no time. It's like, so it was a very difficult task that I found myself in. But we did fairly well, and he had a fair bit of rest time. And I want to tell just one funny story before I go into the details of that and kind of to build up to his, I think, final where he deteriorated to where he quit speaking. We were sitting one evening in the quiet of this monastery, and again, painting the picture, the top of this mountain. It'd be a beautiful place for observatory. You would go outside at night, and you could just see every star in the sky. It was like you could reach up and touch them. And the air was cool and crisp because it was this hilltop and not a mountain as we would know it, but a beautiful kind of elevated setting and a lot of stone and just a wonderful place. And even though it would be cool at night, the stones would hold the heat and you get a little bit of heat off the stone. And so we were sitting in the quietness of this little cottage there. And he had a favorite drink. He called it a communist. And it was kind of his way of saying it was a combination of honey, cocoa, and Coffee Mate. And Coffee Mate was one of these things that we determined was allowable. And of course, we all think it kind of cringe thinking of Coffee Mate now, but it was, in those days, it was something that we determined would allow. And it made a delicious drink and had a very nice taste. So he says, Pabakro, make me a communist. So I went in and, you know, I knew how to mix it just right for him. And the right amount of sweetness and cocoa and the Coffee Mate. And it was rich and thick. And you know, when you don't only eat one meal a day and this is like better than, you know, a chocolate mousse or the equivalent of a chocolate mousse. And we're sitting there and he's sipping his drink, and there were one or two, maybe half a dozen monks around just sitting quietly, and he's kind of sipping his drink and just sitting there. And he said, Sabaino, which means, just translates as contentment, happiness, right? And I just kind of, you just kind of raise your hands and wouldn't even say anything, just kind of acknowledging that he had said something. And he said, Ekatyang Dio. He says, there's one thing missing. I says, Ben Yang Lungpa, Kat Yang. He says, you know, what's missing? He says, Kat Pu Ying. Which translates as, no women. I think that was more for me. I had gone to stay the Pansa with him, and as you'd heard earlier, that it was kind of a coveted position to be his personal attendant, which was kind of handed around between monks and novice monks and kind of back and forth. But since we'd taken this trip together and things, and we had a very close relationship, in that I think he felt a lot of comfort around me and that I was big. One of his symptoms was a kind of a dizziness. Sometimes he would be kind of unsteady on his feet. And I just had growing sensitivity on this trip with him, being close by him to take his arm and whatever. So this kind of just a connection in a way that no one else had really developed with him. And so it was like he was drawing me in. And the humility of the life is one that one definitely wants to be invited into that space. So never would assume anything. At least I wouldn't, and I think most everybody here would agree with that. So that they were always sensitive and open to that there was an invitation to help and to kind of fill in this spot. And so as we would move around on when he'd go for little walks, he'd always like me. And he'd say, "Oh, yeah, Prabhakar, I like him nice and close. He's big, he's strong, and he can kind of hold me up, catch me if I fall." So it was this kind of growing comfort, as I was saying, that he had with me. And during that rains retreat, he started to go around, and it was traditional for him to visit the branch monasteries. And he had a very kind of pressing need to do this in this particular rains retreat, because there had been a problem with one of the senior monks, and there had been some rumors about some very inappropriate behavior by this particular senior monk. And of course it was just rumor, but he wanted to go around. It was like his last, it was almost like the Buddha before his parinirvana. He wanted to go around and see his disciples and give these kind of final teachings. So he had a car available, and he went around to visit these various monasteries. And he would usually always say, you know, he'd say, "Get your bowl and let's go." And so I'd always wait for him to say that, even though I'd prepare his stuff. I would always wait for him to say, you know, "Let's go. You know, if you get go with me, to come with me." So one day he hadn't said that. I had his bowl ready. He was all robed up. Driver was there, and they're in the car. And he hadn't said it, so I wasn't going, as far as I was concerned. And so I put him in the car and help him with the seat belt. And he looks, he says, "Where's your robe? Where's your bowl?" And I says, "Well, I haven't prepared it." He says, "Get it." And it was the kind of the last time that I assumed from then on that I was to be with him, that he wanted me, that it was a gesture that it had developed to the sense that I knew that he always wanted me around, so that I just assumed I would go unless I heard otherwise, which was an incredible honor. And during that time, one of the main messages that he was giving to his senior monks, and these are his most senior disciples that he was most concerned with, was the possibility of deteriorating or inappropriate behavior that might strike anywhere unexpectedly. And here it was, in this rumor of this quite senior monk of his, and everything from people wanting to persecute this monk, to not wanting to believe it, to not thinking it was possible, and the whole kind of range of what people felt about that. But his constant reiteration was that this is something that you need to hold, to contemplate, to investigate the facts. And it was his way of saying that this is a communal affair. We need to hold this as a community, look at it as a community, and make a judgment as a community. And so he was emphasizing and reiterating this everywhere that we went. Towards the end of this rains retreat, before it actually finished, the symptoms were a lot of dizziness. He was not well at all. There were several doctors that had wanted him to come to Bangkok to have more intense care. And eventually towards the very end of the retreat, he kind of got so bad, and it was very close to the end, that he decided that he wanted to go ahead and go to Bangkok and get tests and see what was wrong. So he came down, and he was diagnosed with hydrocephalus, which is water on the brain and the ventricles of the brain. And through a long kind of series of tests and consultations, and ultimately at his own decision and discretion, he decided to have a shunting device. If you look at some of the pictures, especially the one of him and I in the hospital, you'll see that little kind of bump on his head. And then you can look down here, you can see the tube. And what it is, they just put a little simple pump into the ventricle of the brain, and it runs off into the stomach area, and you can just pump it, and it releases this pressure. And this was what he was diagnosed with, as what was causing a lot of his dizziness and so on. And after he had the operation, he definitely felt better. And I mean, there's so many details through this, but just to really kind of run through it. And he felt better for a short time, but it was kind of hard to know. He thought he felt stronger, a little better. He took some time to recover. And then we came back to the monastery. And it was during that time that when we came back, he was starting to go downhill quite seriously, in the sense that he started to not be himself in the way that he spoke and the way that he addressed people. And what was, I think, really harmful during this period, and there's so much speculation around this, but he was a big sucker for medicine, and especially herbal medicine. And everybody had a cure, of course, for whatever was ailing him. And they had some very strong, powerful herbal medicines, and I think he did have symptoms of diabetes. He had all the conditions, which I personally kind of know a lot more about now. He was overweight. He didn't get a lot of exercise. It's a perfect setup for kind of adult onset of diabetes type 2. And he was being given his medicines, only eating once a day, and I think that they did bring his blood sugar down, because I remember the kind of the symptoms. And I think it actually did cause some kind of damage, brain damage, because from then on it was kind of downhill. And until the final, he had said in his final kind of words, when he was still himself, he said, "I don't want to go back to the hospital." He said, "Enough. That's it." He said, I've had it. The doctors have done everything. And his intention with this operation, and I was there with him the whole time, and a couple of these doctors. And his whole, when the final kind of stage of that, when they said, "This is it," and this, you know, this doctor had done this operation hundreds of times, his only intention was not for himself, but that he would be around for a little bit longer, or however much longer, to be able to serve, to continue to serve. That was his very obvious and concern and intention. And but then he had done that, it hadn't worked, and he said, "That's it." Well, then he really was no longer himself. I don't remember the exact details, because I was in such the middle of this 3 years, and Ajahn Pusanok can possibly fill in some of the details. But what happened was that an offer came from a very close supporter of his that was offering him to go to the best neurosurgeon in Thailand, which was the neurosurgeon of the royal family, of the king and the queen. And they offered, so he was being offered to be a royal patient. So his final words were, "I don't want to go anymore," but now he couldn't make that decision. So the community of elders met, and they were then faced with this decision to whether to send him to Bangkok to go under the care of these doctors or not. And they hashed this out for quite some time. And it was a very reasonable decision from what I remember, because they said, well, it's, even though his wishes were not to go back, this was, there's incredible, I mean, this is a great master, and you're getting an offer from the kind of the royalty of the country. So to turn it down and then for something to happen, would be a tragedy. And could be, have repercussions, but also to send him against his wishes had repercussions. So the community was put in a very difficult situation, but in the end they decided to send him to Bangkok and to have care with the royal doctors. And that was really, we spent a short time there, and well, I don't remember how long that we spent until these doctors also said there was nothing more that they could do. Everybody then again decided, the community of elders had come down and said, "Let's take him back to the monastery." It had this beautiful, clinic built for him that was custom made to take care of everything. And so it wasn't like we took him to the hospital, we took the hospital to him. And, it was wonderful. So he came back. And my memory is, we came back, I wheeled him back to us. It was just him and I after we'd arrived. And I said to him, and as far as I know, that this was his last word. And I said to him when we got settled after this trip back, I says, "Do you want to go and walk, go through the, have me push you through the forest in your wheelchair?" And he just kind of mouthed the word "bye," which means go, meaning yes, you know, let's go. And as far as I know, that was the last spoken word. I never, in the rest of the time I was with him until I went to England, I never heard him ever make a verbal gesture after that. And so there's so much more I could say, but I see that the time is moving, and I think Ajahn Pasuno can kind of pick it up from there, because I left and he continued to live on for another 8 years, I guess, after I left, 7 or 8 years. And this course brings up a lot of issues for all of us about, well, we went against his wishes and the care for him and everything. But the beautiful thing about it was it helped the community prepare ultimately for his death, and also in a very wonderful way to pay respects and be an offering gratitude, our service. The kind of care that he got that I feel I really helped to create. There was somebody with him 24 hours a day. You can imagine, you know, a whole hospital taking care of one patient. That's what it amounted to. 24 hours a day. If he just flinched, if he, you know, he didn't have bed sores, he got turned, you know, just as the clock ran, if he, you know, urinated, whatever, that was cleaned immediately. So he had this incredible loving care, and people wore masks, and it was just, you know, beautiful to see the kind of care and refinement that everybody brought to, and was able to express their love and gratitude for all that he had given. So at this point, I'd like to, pass it over to Ajahn Pasuno and kind of take it from there.
Okay. We haven't got a whole lot of time, so there's a few things that came up as Joseph was talking, that I'll just sort of clarify kind of put another angle. Ajahn Chah was a terrible patient. He was a regular pain in the butt to look after. I can remember him. He's got diabetes, and you're trying to get him to look after his diet, and you get the doctors come, and they sit down with him and explain to him what kind of shape he's in, explain to him how he should look after himself, explain to him how what's proper and what's inappropriate for somebody who has this kind of disease. And he sits there very patiently and nodding and smiling, and then finally they finish and he looks at them and asks, "Don't doctors die also?" So he was not easy to look after. He was going to do what he was going to do. And so that was one aspect. Another aspect that shone through is even there's one time when he was in the care of the royal doctors, the doctors of the royal family. He had lost his mobility, his ability to walk, use his limbs, his speech, and they were giving him physiotherapy. And he'd been there for about probably a couple months by that time, or a month or so. And Joseph was stressed. So I came down and gave him an opportunity to get have a break, and I stayed in the hospital and helped look after Ajahn Chah. And I mean, it's really a hard job. So but one day in the afternoon, taking him for a walk in his wheelchair around the hospital grounds, and you know, he's not mobile, he's not speaking, but there was this, we're walking through the grounds, and there was this mother and a young child, son. And there was something quite striking about their posture, or their being, or their kind of faith. They got down immediately by the path and put their hands on Anjali. And there was just something very pure about them. And then Ajahn Chah made a gesture of putting his hand out and to give the... And then I invited the little boy to come forward to bow into Ajahn Chah's hand. And that was like he'd given that opportunity for this mother and this little boy to just pay respects. And it was just so compassionate, and just sort of just the compassion overrode the debilitated body or condition that he was in. It was just so that's an image that always sticks with me. His tremendous compassion, and certainly the, you know, I really feel, and you know, there's, you know, and it's only speculation, but his time of illness, where he was unable to communicate verbally or in any normal way, was really a gift to the Sangha, and really felt it was a bodhisattva act, just tremendous renunciation and giving. And because what it did was have the opportunity for the Sangha to come together. Because this is what, if you think about what is unique about Ajahn Chah's teaching, I mean, we've talked about a lot of uniqueness around his personality, and his method of teaching. But I think, you know, what is really unique is his emphasis on Sangha. And that's the vehicle that's carried these teachings to us. I mean, from the Buddha's time, is through the vehicle of Sangha. So that he really nurtured Sangha. And that, opportunity of his time of illness, gave us as a, and I was sort of in the midst of that, and there was, at the time when he first became ill, I mean, there was about 70 or 80 branch monasteries. By the time he died, there was probably about 160 branch monasteries. I mean, it grew. It strengthened Sangha. It stabilized. That's extraordinarily rare. Usually when a teacher starts to, isn't teaching, isn't present, things start to dissipate and people move away and people, and particularly, with religious figures, there's a saying, there's an idiom in Thai that, people in the world are attached to status. People in the religion are attached to their views. And you better believe it. So that, you get into extraordinary conflicts. And it's also righteous. So that ability for people to drop their views and learn how to work together. Before they would do it because of the power of Ajahn Chah's personality. But now they had to do it because of themselves, and because of the Sangha, and because of the Dhamma. And there were people who fell away and said, I'm out of here. But that wasn't what the majority did. The majority really put an effort. And so that time of looking after Ajahn Chah really helped to consolidate that. And there's many, and we don't have time to do the many stories through Ajahn Chah's life of his, how he emphasized Sangha and really turned things over an ordinary sense, and you know, say like giving the power of decision to the Sangha, or deferring to the Sangha before him making any decision, which is he was extraordinarily capable. He was extraordinarily wise, but that wasn't the point. For he could override people, but that wasn't what he was leaving as a legacy. His legacy was to give Sangha the opportunity to work together and live together, and by that way pass on the teachings that he's done. So that's certainly what I feel he's given to us, and his last illness up to his death. And the, you know, you saw people who were here last night, the funeral ceremony, just sea of faith that was generated. 10 days of practice, and there really was about 1 million people come through Wat Bapong at that time. And the actual day of his cremation, and we had a period of 10 days of practice and meditation and chanting, and it's extraordinarily powerful. Do you need to have, you know, 20,000 people chanting at the same time, or meditating, or, you know, the meal offering for 25,000 people. it boggles the mind. But it all came together. And I think, you know, one of the things that Jack pointed to today, and sort of putting what was it? I mean, you know, the quality of surrender, dignity, honesty. Those three qualities, really. How he lived his life, how he tried to get the Sangha to live. And I think that's you know, hopefully what we can continue to bring into this. And that's, you know, in terms of you know, trying to, like a funeral ceremony for 1 million people. You can't do it by organizing it. You have to surrender. And you've got to carry a dignity about it so that it just happens. So that, on a certain level, this is how this event happened. It pulled together just very nicely. So I'll pass on that.
Sure. We're coming to the close of the 2 days together, and it was pretty astonishing for me to walk in and see everybody sitting here, all of you who are important people in my lives, many of you for decades, and then to hear these stories and see the pictures and so forth. And yet, there's also something a little bit confusing because there's somebody missing. you brought the chair, that's right. But there's somebody missing. There's also this emptiness. There's something, and then there's something that's not here, if you understand what I'm saying. And so just the last little thing I want to say, I remember us going out on alms round, and I just have to say that to go out in the morning before the sun rises barefoot and walk on the little dikes between the rice paddies, you know, after the rainy season, for some miles to a village, which, and then walk through the streets that are unpaved and these dirt streets and these houses made of bamboo with the water buffalo underneath maybe and so forth, and have people come and offer food, especially when we were first there. It felt really timeless. It didn't feel like it was probably very different than it had been 2,000 years before. It was quite, it was one of the great privileges of my life, really, to be able to do that. Very wonderful. So we would go out for alms round. And I remember coming back one day, and Ajahn Chah looked at me and he said, "Did they give you much food?" You know, kind of teasing as he would. And he said, "You know they're not feeding you, don't you?" He said, "They're not, it's not, you don't have enough good karma for them to be really giving you anything." which I kind of agreed with, and I reflected a little for a moment. And he said, you're living off the karma of the Buddha. He said, you go out there, and they don't even know who you are. They ever heard some Westerner with a long nose who's out there, you know, and a shaven head. He said, it's really the karma of the Buddha. They see you and you remind them of something that they so respect and value, this possibility of awakening, the beauty of the awakened heart, the compassion of the Buddha that they've heard about for their whole life, and they see you and you remind them of that karma, and so they'll even give you food because you remind them of that. And there's some way in which I feel like that stream which came from the Buddha and the Buddhas from the awakened ones, and through this long lineages of hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years of practitioners in the forest, of monks and nuns, in the mountains and caves and so forth, down through Ajahn Sao and Ajahn Mun and Ajahn Tongrad and Ajahn Chah, finally to Ajahn Sumedho and the others here, that it's some stream that we have the grace to have entered. It's not really ours at all. And that stream is moving in this room, and we're all in it. You're all in it as well. And that's what matters, that you can feel that stream and let it touch your heart. And the Buddha said at one point, as long as one person on this earth is still truly practicing the teachings of the Dharma, of seeing what's true in with the eyes of a Buddha, then the Dharma will not be lost. And so you have it. I thank you.